Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, Lori Gwen Shapiro talks with Will Hermes about his book Lou Reed, The King of New York, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in October 2023. This interview was recorded at the Bio Conference in New York City on May 17th, 2024.
I'm so excited to be here with you. I'm a longtime listener, and it's exciting to be a reader as well. I'm wondering if you could tell me exactly when you decided to write a book about Lou Reed. What was that moment?
The exact moment was logging onto Facebook, probably in 2013, shortly after Lou Reed passed, and being floored by seeing the outpouring of grief and sort of memories of being a Lou Reed fan, memorials for Lou Reed. It was the first time that I remember noticing a public mourning on social media, which was still fairly in its infancy compared to nowadays. And I knew a lot of Lou Reed fans, being a music journalist, music fan, but the depth of these remembrances, and most of them weren't personal remembrances, but some of them were, people who actually knew him, but it was people talking about how much his work meant to them. And I was like, I love Lou Reed, and I know a lot of people who love him, but I didn't really know how deep this went. This is interesting. And then that it was sort of a tag team realization that this was a book that needed writing when I heard from both my editor and my agent, who were like, you know, there really isn't a great Lou Reed book that covers his entire life. And maybe that should be your next book, since I had written Love Goes to Buildings on Fire about New York music in the mid-70s. Lou Reed appears in that book, but kind of is like an absent father. So it was a logical extension.
Now, of course, you have a wonderful career and a lot of fans yourself, but I'm imagining that this is your first biography. So in many ways, you are a newbie. You're a first-time biographer. So were you terrified at the prospect of writing a biography? And what did you do first?
I guess I had done a biography of a music community in my first book, but a biography of a single person is a totally different animal. And being, being prone to disorganization, I figured, like, let me just start at the beginning and move towards the end. So I live in New York, and I knew Lou Reed spent almost his entire life in New York. And so I went out to where he grew up. I found his childhood home. I went to the Freeport Public Library, met some lovely librarians there, and they actually had just completed a little chapbook on the history of Freeport. So that was great. And then it was off to the races. And along the way, I certainly gained a great admiration for the work of biographers, the challenges, and the anxieties of writing somebody's life, getting involved with the stories of their family, getting involved with their family members, becoming a part of the family in the process of being vetted by people who knew him. Lou Reed was a prickly figure. He was much loved, but he was not loved by everyone. And there had been a lot of unflattering things written about him. There were other books written about him over the years. And I sort of had to pass the test over time. Some people spoke to me immediately. Some people, it took a little wooing and vetting over the years. But yeah, it was a learning process in respect to people who've written more than one biography. I feel like I learned a lot. It was a steep curve.
I think I read something that you said this was not an authorized biography. However, you did have connection to Laurie Anderson, and I'm wondering if you were the first to see the archives that were put in the New York Public Library. Is that key to how you were able to tell new information in a story that other biographers did not have?
Well, that was part of it. And in fact, Laurie Anderson was another trigger for wanting to write this book, because I had interviewed her a number of times, once for my first book, also for a profile in the New York Times back in 2007 or 8, if I remember correctly. And she's just such an amazing person, such a tremendous artist. And I was fascinated by the fact that these two giants of American art and music of the 20th and 21st century connected, and also connected late in life. It was an extra attraction to writing the story. But the book was not authorized, in part because the estate and Laurie did not want to authorize a biographer. You know, Laurie said, good luck. I'd been in communication with her, and over the years of doing interviews, I got the sense that members of his family, Laurie, the estate, were vetting me. But, I had a lot of people come back and say, like, yeah, we spoke to this person or that person. And they said, like, yeah, this guy's okay. Maybe you can talk to him if you want. So that was interesting. I mean, in some ways, I think maybe it was there were some advantages to it not being authorized, because then you can tell the story as you see it, rather than feeling it needs to, be have a top editor in that way.
One of the things I like about a biography that is well written is that there's a sense of place. And obviously New York is a sense of place, but there was other places where Lou Reed spent quite a bit of time. My alma mater, Syracuse University. I want to talk about, what was Lou Reed's connection to Syracuse? And did you go to Syracuse, and did you use their archives? And why is that an important part of his life?
Oh, it was a hugely important part of his life. And if I'm doing my math correctly, not talking touring, he spent more time living in Syracuse as a place outside of New York City than really anywhere else. And he was there for 4 years. And he connected with a lot of folks who were important in his life and his work. His first girlfriend, Shelley Albin, was the subject of many of his songs with the Velvet Underground. But probably most importantly, he met Delmore Schwartz, who was his teacher, great American poet, great writer. He was a guy who had demons, and was near the end of his life, as it turned out, in Syracuse. But he and Lou bonded. He saw that Lou had greatness in him, and he said it on a number of occasions. I interviewed a lot of students from Syracuse who were peers of Lou's, and Lou, to the end of his life, talked about Delmore being like, the first great man he ever met, the author of the greatest short story ever written, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. And research at the Syracuse Library Archives was a lot of fun, because Lou Reed did a zine when he was a student there, the Lonely Woman Quarterly, if I'm remembering it correctly. And it has all of this early writing, which has never been published. It's not even on the internet. I mean, this was a mimeographed zine. They have copies, I guess, of everyone that was done, at least everyone that survives. It's fascinating. Poetry, fiction, or thinly veiled memoir, some like a political satire, sort of screed about a right-wing student group that he was ridiculing. So that was fascinating, and it shone some light on something that was a major facet of Reed's creative life, which was that he identified as a writer from the very beginning. He was making music up in Syracuse, as I found out. He had rock bands. He played folk music with a neck rack for a harmonica because he would do sort of folk revival stuff in a Bob Dylan style. Bob Dylan, who he really sort of saw as, you know, not only an inspiration but kind of a rival. But he, you know, he really identified as a writer, and the evidence is in those zines up in the Syracuse Library for anybody who wants to go up there and do some research.
One of the things that's really astounding about your book is how far you dive into his sexuality, which is complicated. And what kind of person was he at Syracuse, and how did that then develop, and how does that play into your book?
I thought Lou's queerness, and I'm using that word, he did not use that word, the differences in language today versus in the 50s and 60s were something I had to grapple with in the writing of this book. He was certainly curious about his queerness up there. I did not do that much digging about his sexual life, and I was very judicious in how much I used that in the book. But I felt that queerness was so integral to a lot of his music, and he talked about it at a number of points in his life in interviews, not often, but he did. And he did talk about having a crush on this one man who I believe was a guy I spoke to who has since passed. And he talked about their relationship and friendship. I spoke to another person who was a lover of his, a guy. It just felt like that was something that the other biographers did not deal with. He was such like a butch icon, such a macho, tough dude, straight dude icon, that I think a lot of biographers couldn't accept the fact that queerness was in his person. That was just not something that people took seriously. They thought he was just being provocative. He was acting gay. But, you know, I think he was judicious about when he talked about that aspect of himself. And, of course, he had long-term relationships and marriages with cis women. He also had a long-term relationship with a trans woman. These were facets of, you know, of his life that were not entirely incidental, but, you know, I tried to weight them only insofar as they had bearing on his creative life.
If you could tell us a little bit about who Rachel is and what part of the book, how much of the book does this play into your story?
Lou was always interested in the trans experience. I mean, he wrote a number of songs, Candy Says, Walk on the Wild Side, that address Candy Darling. Not specifically, but clearly that's the Candy that's being referred to in both these songs, who is a famous trans actress. And his relationship with Rachel came later. That was in the 70s, and Rachel was a great partner. They were both using drugs a lot, so in some ways they were kind of like enabling each other in some kind of bad habits, unhealthy habits. But they were together for 3 years, and certainly the album Coney Island Baby very specifically involves Rachel. He took her to press events. He did photo shoots with her. She appears on the cover of one of the Best Of compilations that RCA put out. And the end of Coney Island Baby, he basically, you know, dedicates the song to her. It's one of his greatest songs. So a very important part of his life. And I was fortunate enough to meet a relative of hers, a niece, who connected me with Rachel's sister, and spent some time with them at their house looking at old photos. And that was a real special part of the research process, because her story had never really been told fully. So I think I got, I filled in a lot of that story.
Any unexpected places, you know, there's archives at places like Syracuse or the New York Public Library, but I've heard people say, I found something on eBay, or, I mean, was there really any truly unexpected spot that you had a research score?
Yes, some of the discoveries came from you know, I went to a lot of different archives. Maybe the most exciting discovery just came from a friend who met a guy who went to school with Lou Reed when he went to NYU. Before he went to Syracuse, he went to NYU. He had a mental health crisis and withdrew from school. But I met a friend of his from that period, and he showed me a letter. He gave me a copy of a letter that had a lot of information about both their time in NYU and Lou's time in Syracuse, because the letter was written when Lou was in Syracuse. So that was super exciting. The New York Public Library had material on later parts of his life, like the 60s and the 70s were pretty chaotic for him, and there was not a lot of material that he saved. In the 80s, he got his life together, he got healthier, got out of some of his addictive habits, and his second wife, Sylvia Morales, Sylvia Reed, was very good, I think, about helping him, like, keep archives, keep records, and there was all sorts of stuff there. Maybe the most exciting was the cachet of fan mail, and this goes back to me talking about Facebook memorials being an initial inspiration for this book, reading all this fan mail from people who revered him, and sharing, you know, why they liked, connected with his work so much. That was very touching. But it was also like it made me sympathize with him in a new way, because some of the fan mail was creepy. I mean, there were stalkers, there were some vaguely threatening pieces of fan mail, and it made me understand the vulnerability of celebrities in a way that I really hadn't before, especially somebody like Lou Reed, who projected such a tough veneer. It made me understand maybe part of where that tough veneer comes from.
I was telling you right before we started this podcast that I used to ride the elevator once a week with Lou Reed before. It took him 14 weeks for him to give me a smile and say, hey, how are you? I would bring my friends, my husband, everyone. Like, if you come at 12 o'clock on Friday in this building, we can ride the elevator with Lou Reed. But and it never failed. People tell a story about my story. I'm curious if you met Lou Reed, if you interviewed Lou Reed, and how did those experiences inform your narrative at all?
I was going to ask whether you charged for the rides on the elevator with Lou Reed, but that seemed like it's a monetizable event. You know, I only met Lou a couple of times, a few times really, but very, very casually. And I interviewed him once for a New York Times feature profile that I was doing on Laurie Anderson. And yeah, he was kind of surly. He was out walking his dog, as he often did, Lower Manhattan. And he answered questions begrudgingly. But no, I mean, you know, I saw him certainly over the years in concert, so I was really approaching it as a historian and a music journalist, not as somebody who knew him or had a relationship with him. It always was exciting to see him and Laurie out at a cultural event, because they were always out. They were always at places. And even at this conference, the biography conference where we are right now, people are coming up to me going like, oh, I have a Lou Reed story for you. And it's just delightful, because they really were like kind of the king and queen of a particular New York arts demimonde. They went to all sorts of things, movies, plays, concerts, avant-garde productions, all sorts of things. And it, you know, it made you feel like you were a New Yorker when you saw them.
I remember seeing them literally as the king and queen of the Coney Island Mermaid Parade. Just the segue from king and queen. I am under the impression, and stop me if I'm wrong, that Lou Reed famously hated journalists. And I'm wondering what you think he might think of this book. And do you worry about that at all? Does that ever cross your mind?
Well, for many years of being a journalist, I've come to accept that whatever you write about someone, even if you think it's really glowing, they're very likely to have some problem with that. And because people have written about me being an author, I've had some profiles written, I'll read things about myself and be like, well, they kind of got that wrong. So it was good to see it from both sides. I didn't worry about it. I just felt I had to write the best book I could to be as true to the research that I did, to the stories that people trusted me with in researching his life. And I have to say that some people very, very close to him told me that he would have really liked this book. You know, I'm not vain enough to think that that's necessarily true, but it doesn't matter. Like, I feel like I wrote a book that actually felt like it was the best book I could do, and I did get a lot of feedback from people close to him saying that it meant a lot to them, and so I felt, okay, job well done.
I don't think the other biographies of Lou Reed would have covered his death. Am I correct on that?
When I started the book, nobody had written a book that really covered his death. It took me so long to finish this book that biographies were published while I was working on it. So yes, there were some, whether or not we want to include this.
It's a very emotional ending we know that he dies, but I'm wondering how you covered that. What were you thinking about when you were writing that part of his life journey?
Well, that's one of those moments as a biographer, and I hope every biographer has this experience where you're talking to somebody who, you know, might not have been like, you know, on your A-list of, oh, I have to talk to that person because they really are going to have the stories. It was somebody who was further down on that list, and I knew I was going to get some interesting information. But it turned out to be from a bandmate of his who was extremely close to him, with him during a lot of his medical treatments. And he shared stories with me that were so intimate and so touching, like my eyes were literally welling up when I was on this phone interview with him. And I just knew that, like, okay, well, this is going to be the narrative through line of the end of his life. And very late in the game, in fact, the book was in final proofs. I finally got an interview with somebody who was with him during the final days of his life, and shared with me a playlist of the songs that they were listening to in his home when he knew he only had days to live. And that was really profound. So there were those moments that I'm very grateful for people, you know, trusting me enough to share their stories. And I wanted to honor that trust and tell a good story.
Can you tell us who the names of the people were that shared those precious stories with you at the end?
Sure. It's probably not insignificant that they were both musicians. Kevin Hearn, who was the keyboardist and band leader for Lou's band during his final years, and Jenny Muldaur, who was a good friend of his, and also of Hal Wilner, who was incredibly helpful with this book. Hal passed in the early months of COVID, sadly, but he was a great encouragement, very, very close friend of Lou's in his final years.
I want to ask, since this is a podcast for biographers and fans of biography, I guess, what are some of the things that you learned not to do? Or like, what kind of tips can you offer anyone who wants to write a biography, particularly about someone who's so well-known, or a musician, anything that comes to mind?
Well, I'll say one thing that I think I did right. And that was when I decided to write this book, I told my publisher, my editor, that this is going to take a long time. Like, I'm not going to be like, if you want a biography that gets knocked out in a couple of years, I'm not your guy. But if you want this to be something that aspires to be a definitive biography, then I'm the right person for the job. But it will, you know, I tend to over-report everything, which is not necessarily a great trait for a journalist, because, you know, when you have to turn stuff around on deadline, over-reporting, you know, is not necessarily compatible with that. But I think it served me well for the biography, because you know, I think I did a good job with it, but I would encourage people to just take the time you need to do the research, because no matter how long you take, when that book comes out, you're probably going to find something out that you wish you could have gotten into the book. I'm glad that I took the amount of time that that I did, in large part because the New York Public Library archives, which you'd asked about earlier, they were not even on my radar when I started the book. And when it became clear that Lori was looking for a home for Lou's archives, it wasn't clear where they were going to land. At one point, they may have gone to the University of Texas, the Harry Ransom Center. They have a great archive, which I actually did use for some other holdings they had that were Lou Reed related. But when she gave them to the New York Public Library, I didn't know how long it was going to take them to catalog it and make stuff available, because once they were given to the library, I couldn't access them until they were cataloged and made available to everyone. And that happened in 2019, and I spent the summer of 2019 there, turning every page, as Robert Caro says. You know, then of course the pandemic happened, and the library was shut down for, you know, a couple years maybe. So you couldn't, wouldn't have even been able to access that stuff. That was one of the things that came from taking so darn long to finish the book, and I was glad I got access to the archives.
What comes next for you? I mean, I know that the book, my understanding, came out in October of 2023 in hardcover. The paperback is coming out October of 2024. Are you working on a project? Are you thinking about working on a project?
I'm thinking about working on a project that I have no idea what it's going to be. The blank slate that comes after you finish a big book project, or any kind of project, I guess, you know, the postpartum, is kind of scary. Like, it was so blank for a few months that I was like, oh, man, what do I do now? But now that I've kind of got back into doing some journalism, and I recently wrote a piece about a singer-songwriter that very few people know about, Margot Gurian, very interesting Queens-born New York City-based artist who really just had one record but has kind of become a cult favorite. Working on a feature about her made me think, like, I'm not necessarily going to write a biography of her, but it gave me some of the feelings that, like, oh, yeah, there's another project that I could get excited enough about to want to spend a bunch of years working on. So something's out there. I just don't know what yet.
Is there anything that you wish that I ask you that you really want to get into this podcast?
Well, since it's for biographers, I guess, or people interested in maybe being biographers, I'd say go for it. I didn't necessarily think I was a biographer going into this. I'm still not 100% sure I am a biographer, but I guess I am. You're writing the story of a person's life, and you are a person with your own life story, life narrative. And I think you learn a lot about yourself and about your own relationship to other people, to family. So it was incredibly satisfying, not just for having written a good book, I think, about a very important person, but also as a human being, to like learn about, you know, the struggles that people have, and, you know, just how much we, sounds like a cliche, but just how much we have in common, and how, you know, people sometimes do nasty things, and, you know, maybe there's some reasons behind that that you don't know. I feel like maybe I came out of it a better person in some way. So yeah, I'd say if you're thinking of doing a project, make sure that you carve out the time and go for it.
What do you think that you learned that other biographers didn't learn? What was the main thing that you've added to the canon of Lou Reed?
Well, I think when you write about somebody who's really famous, which he is worldwide, and somebody who's had books written about them before, is that, you know, there's a persona that celebrities can never really shake. And Lou Reed, for many people, was like, oh, he was like a mean dude. Like he had a spiritual resting bitch face, I think is a phrase I used at one point. But I really feel like I was able to write about him as a human being that was really beloved, that was so kind and generous, sweet, tender to so many people. I was thinking like, oh, maybe these are just people trying to like put a good face on his nasty persona. But it really made me feel like, you know, there's many sides to everybody. And I think I wrote a fully dimensional portrait of a guy who maybe wasn't portrayed in all the facets of his character in previous books. Or at least I hope that I added a worthy volume to the shelf of Lou Reed books.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Lori Gwen Shapiro in conversation with Will Hermes about his book, Lou Reed, The King of New York. It was published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in October 2023. This interview was recorded in New York City on May 17th, 2024. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.